In Ecclesiastes this evening. Hopefully you had a chance to print off the questions or take a look and go through them, think about some answers. We'll spend most of our time in chapters 1 and 2 this evening, but I do plan on kind of giving an intro or an overview of the book a little bit, just to kind of set up our study for the rest of this next 6 weeks or so that we'll be in the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Starting in verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labors in which he toils under the sun? And so what an intro, right, to a letter. When you first read these first couple of verses of this letter, what comes to mind? What's the tone that's set right off the bat at the beginning of this letter?
Sobering.
Yeah, sobering. Anything else? Yeah, a little depressing. What was the other word I heard? Something I heard in the back? Meekness. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, certainly. I think the word Sarah uses is a little bit of the word I think of is a little depressing, right? If all is vanity, everything that we see, what does this word vanity mean? What do you see when you see this word vanity?
Empty.
Emptiness. Yeah. Nonsense. Meaningless. Empty. So worthless. And so to start off a letter by just saying everything is just worthless. Everything's just worthless. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? So basically, what's the point? What's the point of what we're doing here? What's the point of life? What are we doing? Why are we here? And so it is a little depressing to start a letter. And in fact, that tone is pretty consistent throughout the letter. You can look at the last chapter in verse 8, chapter 12 and verse 8. He there says the same thing. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. And so for, 11 plus chapters, that seems to be a lot of the tone that's taken to the audience. What does the word Ecclesiastes mean? That was question number one that I sent out. What does this word Ecclesiastes mean?
Preacher.
What else?
Teacher.
Right, so it has kind of as a combination of those two meanings. It's a preacher, teacher, one who is preaching and teaching to an assembly. Okay, so it's a little bit of a combo. So you'd almost think like somebody who's up in a pulpit on a Sunday morning preaching a sermon to a gathering of people. So it's not necessarily an intimate one-on-one teacher per se, but there's another word that we are more familiar with that we can see within this word Ecclesiastes is ecclesia. An assembly, a called out, a gathering, a collection of people. So it's this idea of teaching and preaching to a collection of people. Why is that ironic considering this tone? Does anybody else find that a little odd? I mean, if we were coming to hear a sermon in a group of people and a preacher, Jason's going to get up in the pulpit on a Sunday morning, and the first thing he said was, nonsense, worthlessness, vanity. This is all just worthless. It's not quite the tone you would think of when you think of a sermon or preaching to a collection of people. So I think I find a little irony there in that word Ecclesiastes and preacher with the tone that he starts with. But one thing I want to make really clear is that you know, we probably all have friends or acquaintances or maybe family members or know people very close to us who do kind of view life through this lens, right? That, you know, what's the point? Why are we here? This is all just meaningless. There's no meaning. There's no hope. And so this book, actually, I found the more that I study it, the more I actually find it very hopeful and not meaningless, but very meaningful. And for the reason, quite frankly, is the very last two verses of the book. So if you turn to chapter 12 and verse 13, it says there, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." And so when we look at the first three verses of the book and the last two verses of the book, what are some of the conclusions that we should draw from this? Is this just a crazy person who's just ranting about how worthless life is and how meaningless life is, how this is all nonsense? Or is there a much deeper meaning that we should be drawing from this book? Anything else?
Well, I think that when you, especially after you read through it and see what he's doing, he's putting things in perspective. And he's basically saying, hey, if all you're thinking about is this world, then yeah, it's all vanity. It's worthless. You're wasting your time. There's more to it than that. And the thing that I find interesting is that it's not just him saying, okay, hey, there's more to it than that. He's talking about, here I am, and I sought wisdom, and I gave myself to all these things, and here's what I found and determined as a result of my searching. So if there's a little bit of a kind of hands-on, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but there's an experience here that has brought him to the conclusion that he's trying to help others see.
Yeah, Glenda. Right. And I think why this strikes me so much as far as this word preacher and preaching to an assembly or a gathering is because the tone of this book is more of like a grandfather or a father sitting at a kitchen table with their child, with their son. You know, I'm kind of putting myself in that position that my grandfather is sitting down at the kitchen table and he's saying, here's all the things I did wrong in my life. Here's all the lessons I had to learn in a very hard way. And my grandfather's had conversations like that with me. And here's why you should try to do things differently than what I did. But it's not a tone necessarily that you'd see a preacher stand up in a pulpit and be so intimately intimate and honest about their failures. And I think those of us who have maybe sat down at a kitchen table with a preacher, they may be willing to have conversations that they're not going to have, you know, from the pulpit for that reason, where they're going to talk about more personal life experiences. So that's one of the things that really stood out to me with this tone and this word Ecclesiastes, and what I hoped that we would see in this first study and kind of remember as we go through the rest of the book. The tone, the purpose, and what the author is trying to get, what the preacher is trying to get across to the listener. Any other thoughts on this word Ecclesiastes or tone. So who is the author? Okay, I heard a vote for Solomon, the preacher, right? I feel pretty confident saying Solomon. I'll point out a few things here for why I feel that way. Verse 1, the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. I mean, I think we can start to narrow things down there. Verse 12, the preacher, king over Israel in Jerusalem. And then verse 16 in particular. Look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Okay, so just when you kind of put together just those first few verses from chapter 1, I think I can confidently say, I know that's a little bit of a still pretty hedging my bets, right? I can confidently say that I think this is Solomon, okay? And I think that gives us a good perspective of how the meaningfulness of this book. When you view it through the lens of what Solomon experienced, his wisdom, and the fact that he most likely wrote this book at a later stage in his life, perhaps, it carries a lot more weight with it, I think. Any thoughts on that? Opinions? Would love to hear them. And this idea of under the sun, as Glenda pointed out, just a few minutes ago. So the other thing that we have to remember is that the book is written to show and from the perspective of life under the sun. Okay, so we need to really make sure that we're holding on to that statement. We'll remember that as we go through the book, that this is all through the lens of if you are viewing life as being only from the perspective of under the sun, nothing above the sun, as Glenda put it, then all is going to be vanity for you. That's your ultimate conclusion at the end of the day is, what's the point of this? Is there any meaning behind this? Why am I here? What am I doing? One of the things that Jason has pointed out in a recent lesson, either last Sunday or the Sunday before that, is if we look at this book of Ecclesiastes, and think of just three questions. And the three questions that he asked was, who am I? Who are we? Or where am I from? Who am I? Where am I from? Why am I here? And then where am I going? Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? If you're viewing life as being only under the sun, it's very difficult to answer all three of those questions. And by asking yourself all three of those questions, it really puts life in perspective of maybe there is more than just under the sun. There must be something more to this. Otherwise, everything that we see is just nonsense. And we're going to look at some of the reasons why Solomon concluded that all this would, or the writer would concluded why all this would be nonsense if you are viewing life from under the sun. Okay, so what is the purpose and theme of the book? And we've kind of walked all over this, but this is question number 3. So just to make sure we kind of check our boxes as we go along. Okay, anything else? Yeah, what is of value in this life? To show what man is to do. What else? So three statements that jump out to me as I study this book is vanity, under the sun, and this statement, grasping for wind. And when you think of grasping for wind, what do you think of? Yeah, effort and futility. What else? It's like that statement of trying to hold back the tide. And we have all sorts of statements that kind of fit that similar idea, right? That you're trying to fight something that cannot be fought. You're trying to overcome something that cannot be overcome. There's a statement in among sports commentators that Father Time is undefeated, right? So we all are going to grow older. We all are going to die. And so this idea of cycles of life, vanity, grasping for wind, and under the sun really jump out as far as purposes and themes of the book. Are there any others that we'll see or that you thought of? Yeah, Wade? Absolutely. So picking up in verse 3 and continuing through verse 11, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It's already been in ancient times before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. So what's he describing here in these 9 verses 3 through 11? What's being described here? And what point is he drawing? Right. So what are the cycles that he uses to describe the physical cycles that he uses here as descriptions to give us perspective? Yep. The sun. Yeah. Generation. So we got people, the cycle of people, one generation after the next. We have the sun going up and coming down. And we're just revolving, we're revolving around the sun. We have the pattern of winds, we have the pattern of waters, and then there's this labor pattern that seems to be described here in verse 8 as well, where you're just working and toiling for money to spend, to work and earn and spend and work and earn and spend. And so it's just this constant cycle that we see. And what is his ultimate conclusion from that in verses 9 through 11? Is there anything new that we're seeing today that we haven't already seen? Now, what would the scoffer say about that? What would somebody, you know, somebody of the world say about that? What would be their response to that? See, is there anything new? What would be their response?
Is
Right. Yeah. Look at technology. Look how far we've come with modern technology and medicine and different things. We're the most advanced civilization that's ever been. Well, what's the problem with that? Every civilization before has said that. We are on a constant cycle of saying that. So every civilization along the way has thought, we're the more advanced. Look at our generation. We're more advanced than that generation. Then the next generation is going to say the same thing. And so on and so forth. But yet we still fall for one of two things. Either lust or pride since the beginning. The lust of our flesh, our eyes, what we see, or our pride, our internal pride. And it's been that way since the beginning. No matter how much our civilization has advanced and progressed, and we like to throw out this term progressive now, and we're so much more progressed than the previous generation, but we're still falling for the same form of sin and depravity that we see back in the book of Genesis. And so Solomon is making the conclusion here, rightfully, that there's nothing different. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything that you think that you're seeing new, it's been tried just in a little bit different way. Maybe a little bit different means or method, but it's essentially the same exact thing. It's falling under one of those two areas where it's something that people are lusting after, or their pride is affecting this decision and what they're doing. Anything from that? Absolutely. There. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree. I believe that is an answer to verse 3. Thank you for the comments. Debbie, please. And that's why we'll never find happiness in physical things on this earth. True joy, true happiness. There's not that in physical things. Yes, we can enjoy blessings from God. We'll see verses from that later in the book. And we can see that even in James chapter 1, that these gifts are blessings from God, and there is possible to enjoy those blessings and still be faithful and still be looking above the sun, looking heavenward. But we're never going to find true joy and true happiness in physical things on this earth.
You're all about this. You're all about making money. You're all about having more power or whatever it is. All about this, you're never satisfied. It's never enough. You can't be truly happy. But going along with that, what you're just talking about, if you have the right mindset and you are living your life for God and you're seeing things from that perspective, then you are satisfied with whatever you have, just like Paul was. Whatever situation I find myself in, I'm okay. Because you can be satisfied with whatever little you have or how much you have.
Yeah, I run into a lot of, you know, a lot of my college students want to talk about, you know, I want to find a job that'll make me happy. They say that a lot. I want to win an audition. I want to get a job that just makes me happy. And it just, it's too much. Every time I hear him say that, you're going to have to learn how to be happy and find joy and then let that take care of itself. If you're trying to find happiness in a job, you're going to get there and you're just going to find out that there are people there who are miserable. And it doesn't matter what job it is, that you can pick the most ideal job ever, the most ideal situation. There are people in those jobs who are absolutely miserable. And to see that at a young age, I got the experience and you go, well, wow, then if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. And so we have to always keep in mind, what are we trying to find joy in? Where are we trying to look for our happiness? Because when you look at here at starting in verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task that God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind, for much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what did the preacher set his heart to do? Yes, he can explore wisdom. Concerning what specifically?
I think it's kind of trying to figure out by using this, why do we do all these things? What use of these things? You know, where's the profit of these things?
All this done under heaven, under the sun, because of this burdensome task that God has given to the sons of man. What's interesting to me is that he sets his heart, and this word heart keeps coming up. Verse 13, I set my heart. Verse 16, communed with my heart. 17, or at end of 16, my heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. Verse 17, I set my heart to know wisdom. Continues on in chapter 2, verse 1, I set in my heart. Verse 3, I searched in my heart. What's the problem with that? What's the good of that? Does that strike you as coincidental?
The problem is he's trying to find the answers within himself because he thinks he's wise, which the previous Solomon told him he's going to be the one who thinks he has to be right. When you think about Solomon at large, girlfriend is about 18 or 20 years old. He was on the phone for about 40 years. And I think that he probably fell away from God for about 20 years. If he ever did repent, you know, that's when that fell. That's between him and God. But just think about him chasing after him coming to the sun. I don't want to get ahead of you, but chapter 2, verse 10 says, whatever his eyes desire, he will act. But as a young man, he asked God, he said, I'm like a child. So do righteousness and do justice. He would judge this way people would. So he started out a pretty wise kid, 18 or 20 years old. And then he takes his eyes off God. And then at the end of his life, I think Ecclesiastes was pretty good. He said, wow, I should have listened to my former self and kept my eyes on God instead of everything on the side. You know, we today, I mean, people, we do the same thing, right? I remember reading this as a teenager thinking, I want to believe this, but I haven't experienced enough life to know if this is true. And we already get when you get in your 20s and 30s and then your 50s, you're like, wow, I should have done better. I should have listened to this. Like I thought that I should have listened to this. But we all have to experience things to some extent for ourselves to grow in our own wisdom. We don't always listen to this.
Kind of get to your question as to, okay, what kind of structure here, but it's more, why of all things is he, okay, I'm going to set my heart to do these things. At this community, it's like, okay, you want to get a lesson in futility, that's probably it. I mean, why is that suddenly becoming the focus of your life? Type of thing. And I don't know. You almost get this, at least I do. It's like, okay, I've built my houses, I've built the Lord's house, I'm at peace with the nations around me. I don't really have anything else to do right now. Let's go figure out all this stuff here. It doesn't mm-hmm. now, you know, I do have all this wisdom, all these people come to listen to me and everything, so let's try to figure all this out. And just kind of become this Greek philosopher,
Yeah. I think that's what struck me is just this idea of that's what he set his heart to do. Instead of, we've been talking a lot about how God wants our heart. He wants us to give him our heart. And this idea of giving our heart to God and the writer here is setting his heart to let's just figure out if there is anything under the sun that has any meaning. And not that he's writing this from the perspective of, okay, I'm going to do all these things. He's looking back, right? He set his heart to seeking earthly pleasures, and this is the result. He's coming to a conclusion now writing about that. But still, the fact that what he set his heart to do was to seek after these things. And we know from Jeremiah 17:9 that the heart can be deceiving. And so when we just listen to our heart and we just follow our heart, it can lead down this path where we fill our heart with things that we really shouldn't be filling our heart with, and we end up loving things that we should not be loving, and it can get us into a lot of trouble. So why did the preacher feel like he was qualified to do this, to have this experiment? Yeah, I've attained greatness. I've gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. So he's recognizing all the wisdom that he's been given and chosen to set his heart on things under the sun instead of things of God. And what's his conclusion, verses 17 and 18? What's the conclusion that he came to? Yeah, it's just grasping for wind. As Nick said, this fight, you know, this futility, this lesson of futility. You're just grasping for the wind. You're trying to hold back the tide. You're not gonna fill that empty void in your heart by chasing after things of this earth. So, chapter 2, again, in verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness. and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possession of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments of all kind. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. All my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which they had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. What's this word mirth? You might not have that in your translation. Verse 2 and verse 1. What's this word mirth? Yeah, or like earthly pleasure, earthly joy, physical joy. So joy that you would find, what we'd call it, maybe shallow or under the sun. And so what were some of the things that the preacher did to find earthly joy, to find mirth? What do we see that here in these first 11 verses of chapter 2? So verse 3 stands out to me. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. Okay, so it's, you can see how there's like this little, almost, he's justifying what he's doing. Well, I was participating in this, but I was guiding my heart. I was protecting my heart with wisdom. I was doing these things. And, you know, we might say moderation, right? When we read this, we're not thinking, wow, that doesn't sound like moderation at all. But within his heart, he's guiding his heart with wisdom. He's thinking, well, I'm being moderate. I'm practicing some moderation. And so I'm having wisdom. I'm letting my heart kind of guide me. And so you can almost see there's a little bit of a justification there in verse 3 for why he decided to kind of start going down this path. And I hope that you all can, you know, feel the same as I do, that I've done this myself at many times. Like, you, when you really want to do something, it's really easy to justify it to yourself. If you really want to find a justification, you can find one. You can find somebody who will justify it for you, or you can find something written that will justify it for you. If you really want to do something badly enough, you're not going to find the answer of no anywhere. You're going to only find sources that tell you yes. And so if you're letting your heart guide you and you think you're, you know, following wisdom or being wise and seeking a bunch of counsel, you also got to be careful of where you're seeking that counsel and where your wisdom is rooted in. Any thoughts, any other thoughts about these first 11 verses?
why is there every verse about the Corinthians chapter? Is it just in the dominant? Is it the humility of God? Is it the glory? Is it correct to say all these great things God bless you?
There's not.
It's also sobering as, like, from a parenting perspective, give this to Solomon good, it seems likely. And then you sort of fast forward to Rehoboam, his own son, and the first kind of key decision he faced with his king, he chooses poorly, and he's a fine being there. So even Solomon, all his wisdom and all this great, you know, learning and experience, he wasn't able to pass that on.
And his son probably from my example of probably Solomon. You know what he asked
him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in verse 12, in chapter 12, verse 12, that stands out that he says, "And further, my son, be admonished by these." So we have this word Ecclesiastes, a gathering of an assembly of a preacher who's preaching to a gathering or assembly, but it takes that very intimate turn in the last couple of verses, right, where he addresses the reader, my son. And even before that, a couple, chapter 11, O young man. So it does seem that maybe he is writing to his son, possibly Rehoboam, in those final days. And so it does take a very intimate turn there. And that I found that very interesting in chapter 12, that sudden pivot from all his vanity to, okay, son, now to summarize, fear God and keep his commandments. That is the all of man. And so at the very end, that is his conclusion from this grand experiment that he goes on to seek joy and pleasure under the sun. There was none. And he wants to make that very clear, to his audience. So what is the end result of both the wise and the fool? Verses 12 through 16. And I turn myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this is also vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. What is that end result? They're both going to die. Death. Wise fool, we're all going to die. Hebrews 9 tells us that. Hebrews 9:27, that there will be death. And then there will be the judgment. And so, although the preacher here is coming to the conclusion that it's all vanity, doesn't matter, wise or fool, you both die. Hebrews 9:27 makes that very clear, that there's going to be a judgment. And we're going to see the preacher reach that same conclusion at the end of this letter, that God is going to judge all works in the end. So we better fear him. We better keep his commandments, because all those works are going to be revealed. You know, this reminds me a little bit of the story in Luke chapter 12, where the rich man gets a more bountiful harvest, and his reaction is, well, I'm just going to build bigger barns so I can store more stuff. And it was just all about this accumulating worldly goods and possessions, and it was all focused on here and now, everything under the sun. And Jesus' conclusion was, fool. That's such a foolish thing to have just that perspective only of life under the sun, because tonight, what could happen? Your soul could be required of you. You may die. And if you die tonight, what would it matter? Well, according to Ecclesiastes, it would be vanity in that story. rich man who gathered all this stuff together, and then he dies, and he never got to enjoy it. It was all focused on life under the sun. And so it would all be vanity for him in that situation. And so Jesus rightfully says, that's foolish. That's a really foolish thing to think of. A really foolish perspective to have. And we can fall into that trap very, very easily when we start thinking about how much can we gain in this life? What can we accumulate? How far can we get ahead? What's next? What's next? And we're searching for constant happiness with things on this earth. It's just going to be grasping for wind. There's going to be more wind. We're going to see another cycle of wind. You're just going to have to grasp for that next cycle of wind, and you're never going to actually grab it. So you're never going to feel the satisfaction of your labors. With the last minute or so, what's the result of our labor and wealth here at the end of chapter 2? What's one of the things that the preacher realizes about all the wealth that he's accumulated and the possibility of that wealth, of what could happen? It's going to go to someone else, and even more specifically, what kind of person could that be? They could be wise with it, or they could be foolish with it. I don't have any idea because I'm dead. And so I've left all this wealth and material blessings to somebody who is going to make their own choices. Now, is this saying that leaving an inheritance for our kids is wrong? No, it's not saying that. You know, we read in Proverbs chapter 13 a few weeks ago, 13 and verse 22, that a wise man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, to his grandchildren even. So what is this saying? What is the point of this?
Building all these things and laboring this way and getting that, you know, all, whatever you get of the fruit of your labor, you can't take it with you. It's not worth anything. You're going to leave somebody and they may squander it in a day. So you got your folks the wrong way. What, you know, what you get to later on and throughout this is, are you doing these things to bring glory to God? And using them that way. It's not wrong to be rich. It's wrong to love money. And that being your entire focus. But you can be rich and use those riches in a way that brings glory to God and helps those around you. That's where you're going to get the satisfaction.
Because we hear this statement, you know, leaving a legacy. Right? We want to leave a legacy. I want to leave something behind. I want to make a difference. I want to leave a legacy. And to know that, as Wade pointed out, you know, we're just dropping the bucket in the grand scheme of life and the revolutions around the sun. We're just a drop in the bucket, and we're to make a difference. We're to be a light for Jesus. We're to serve God, keep His commandments. That is the all of man. So that's the point. That's the ultimate conclusion. So as we go through this book and through the remaining 10 chapters, just remember that perspective. That he's given us a view of life under the sun, and the ultimate conclusion is that after this journey of seeking pleasure under the sun, he comes to the conclusion that we are to fear God and keep His commandments. Thank you.